Hello, I'm here with Miriam Cook on December 17th, 2018. We are going to talk about the beginning of the organization AMUSE. So, hello, Miriam.
Hi, Ellen.
We're going to, I wanted to ask first about, can you talk a little bit about your experience when you first joined AMUSE?
Yes, I'm not quite sure when it was, but it must have been very soon after I came to America. I came to America in 1980. And I remember meeting with some members of AMUSE, and maybe at that point they were not, AMUSE was not yet an organization. Mm-hmm. But what I do remember is that I was warned about my position here at Duke. I had been offered the position mm-hmm. of lecturer, and having come from Oxford, mm-hmm. where a lecturer is almost the equivalent of associate professor, I was extremely proud of my new position, and I was told that, in fact, it was a very poor position, and that I mm-hmm. needed to really change it, and I needed to get myself onto tenure track, which I then took to heart, mm-hmm. and within a few months of speaking with some of, I assume, the leaders of what was to become AMUSE, then spoke with my dean, a wonderful woman, and I was then put onto tenure track. So that was my first lesson with AMUSE. And after that, As I say, I can't remember exactly when AMUSE was formed, but I know I was not there at its formation. But I soon became friends with people who were very involved with it, so Saad Joseph, Sandra Hale, Margot Boudron, Amane, Jamal, and was an enthusiastic participant, but did not become really active until, to my surprise, I was nominated and then elected to be president.
So do you have a sense, what was the initial mission of AMUSE at the beginning? I mean, what was your feeling for kind of the aims and goals of AMUSE from in that early cohort?
I think that it worked and felt like the women's faculty network at Duke. And that was more like an advocacy group, kind of supported each other in the way that I've just described. No, lecture is not a great position. You really need to get onto tenure track. People who weren't getting tenure, we tried to help them. So it was more like a grassroots women's support network. And throughout that earlier period, the idea of putting something onto paper started to emerge. So in the beginning, that was somebody else. Eleanor D'Umato was also part of this early group. And a wonderful independent scholar, very interested in Saudi Arabia and women in Saudi Arabia. And so she started the newsletter, and it was a mimeographed newsletter. I think a lot of the women's organizations in the maybe 60s, 70s, and early 80s were like that. And this mimeographed newsletter of two or three pages would then be sent to the membership. And I don't know how much we paid for membership at that time, but it might have been $10, something like that. It was very, very cheap. And that helped to defray some of the expenses that Eleanor had. And then that developed into something that was a little more formal. It was not just clipped at the top, but it looked more like a little booklet. And I think that the synergy between our annual meetings, so a group of women interested in Middle East women's issues, and the beginnings of our appearance on paper, even if it was rather scrappy at the time, I think we were rather proud of it. But, you know, when you look back on it now, it does, it looks very basic. But I think that relationship between the lived meetings, obviously long before internet, email, long distance conferencing, proved to be productive. And it was also fun. We would try to keep Eleanor apprised of the things that we were doing. So that was the beginnings of a sense of us not just meeting at Mesa once a year, but beginning to have a sense of who was doing what, getting to know each other as academics with lives that and activities that spread around the globe. So Val going off to stuff in Iran, and Sandra doing stuff in Sudan, and Soaya doing stuff in Lebanon. And when we were meeting in the beginning, just as a group who didn't have any much follow-up beyond that group, began to have a sense of the fullness of their academic intellectual lives outside the annual meeting.
Well, I guess that leads me to another question as well, is about the state of the field at that particular time, in terms of Middle East women's studies, and then how the organization perhaps coalesced the field or influenced the field.
That is really a wonderful question, because, of course, in the early 80s, to be in women's studies was not a really great thing. It's sort of like interdisciplinary studies at the beginning of the 2000s or during the 90s. Kind of a nodding acknowledgement that field existed, but it wasn't the kind of thing that you would get tenure for, that you wouldn't be taken seriously. It's like so many of these fields. Film studies that weren't taken seriously in the 70s and then became central to cultural studies. So, yeah, to be working in women's studies was to be out there and to risk the possibility of getting a serious job or of getting tenure because one wasn't doing something that was important. And it was meetings of AMU's faculty and also the Berkshires. So being involved with these women meant that I learned about other women's studies meetings, the NWSA, and beginning to go to these other meetings and to realize that there was a movement to make, to mainstream women's studies, whether it was in a separate department or to literally mainstream women's studies throughout the disciplines. But that was something that I think AMUS was really important for many of us as very junior scholars.
Well, what about the intellectual state of the field at that particular time? I mean, what did it kind of consist in and of?
I think at that time it was really easy to be the first.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the first study in women's movements in the Arab world, the first to study peasants in Iran, the first to study literature, the first in philosophy, the first in anthropology. It was very exciting because there had been so little published work. And what was available was mostly anthologies. So, for example, B.J. Frenia was really, really helpful in promoting the voices of women from the Middle East, but not so much in analytical, theoretical works, but rather in anthologies, where she would travel around either alone with her husband or with a colleague and collect these voices. So that became a rich resource. But the idea of theorizing women's issues throughout the disciplines was so new.
Yeah, great. Can you talk a little bit about, would you like to talk a little bit about when you became president?
Yeah, I can't really remember too much beyond the fact that I really, really, really wanted this to become a more Middle East-oriented association. So I was in touch with a number of people from Egypt and North Africa, particularly Hoda Asada and the Women in Memory Forum. And I was hoping to introduce another conference, another meeting for AMU's members that would be in MENA. It never did work out. I had somewhat encouraging responses from people who, after I had been president for a while, told me that they didn't like the way AMU's was functioning, that it felt very cliquish, that it was always the same people. And so my argument was, yes, I feel it's too cliquish and always the same people, and that we need help. So I wasn't particularly successful there, but what did happen is that there was the beginning of an idea about this association being separated a bit from MESA. So it wasn't just this ancillary baby organization, but that it had its own life. So that was, I would say, that was one of the things that I tried to do. And then in my last year as president, I think that's right, it was the last meeting. You're going to have to correct some of these dates because they're a bit vague for me. But I think it was 2003, which was my last year, that was in Alaska. That can be easily checked. There were very few who went to Alaska, complicated to get there, expensive, too cold. And I was seated next to Janet Rabinovich, who at the time was the editor-in-chief of Indiana University Press. And she and I had been very friendly for a while, because Indiana had taken over the publication of Opening the Gates, the anthology that Margot Bedran and I had published in 1990 through Virago in London. And Indiana picked up the American side and, oh my goodness, more than quadrupled the number of copies sold. And I think she was so happy with her relationship with Margot and me that she was interested in listening to ideas about whatever. So I said, you know, we've been talking about this journal and stuff hasn't really come together. What do you think? And as Amane remembered at my celebration retirement last year, I got a huddle of some of us in the plane in the days before they told you not to huddle around the toilets. There we were, and talking with Janet, and Janet was excited, and it was, I guess, absent the public, the signatures to the contract. She pretty much was on board for JMuse.
Great. So this was the beginning of JMuse as a journal and an entity. Can you talk a little bit about the beginnings of JMuse and kind of the initial struggles around the journal, and then perhaps talk about what the vision was, and then actually how it actually played out?
Yeah. Well, I think that I can speak on behalf of Sandra and Amane and Soad when I say that we did not want to be editors. And we did not want to be editors because this was part of the whole thing of opening JMuse up and JMuse as its arm, publication arm. We didn't want this to be us again. It had to be new voices. And I felt also very strongly that we needed to have the next generation who were doing very different kind of work from the kind of work that we were doing in the 80s and 90s, who would bring something very fresh and exciting to JMuse. And so one by one, I guess we broke down and ended up doing, you know, editorial work. But in the beginning, it was Marcia and remember her name. We're going to have to get rid of
Marcia
this part.
And Horn.
And yeah, and woman from Wisconsin who does Greek and anyway, Leyoun.
Mary Leyoun.
Mary Leyoun.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I didn't hear.
I kind of wanted that.
So Marcia and Mary finally had their arms twisted so far up their backs that they did finally agree to do it. I think Mary had too much going on, so after a year she resigned and Marcia kept on being editor. And then we had Sandra and Nancy, and again, so here was Sandra having sworn that she would not edit. But then when Nancy Gallagher agreed to do it with her, I think she felt that she should be helpful. In the same way that, you know, I think I felt it would be helpful for me to co-edit for 4 years when the journal came here and Banu Gokarksel and Frances Hasso and I took over the editing. So, yeah, in the beginning, it was really a matter of twisting people's arms, and I hope that this is not the case with you guys.
So, I guess one of the last questions is, can you speak a little bit about your thoughts about the vision for the future of the journal, but also of the organization in terms of the long term, the longevity of both?
Yeah, well, I still feel so strongly that the organization is too American-based. And this has to be changed at some point. And I think that, again, the synergy between the publication and the human contact is helpful in this way. So, although all of the meetings have been in America, the submissions from MENA have increased enormously, so that when you read JMuse now, or for quite some time, there are a number of publishers, a number of writers, who are from the region. Some who are actually born there, some who've moved there. And of course, we have many Arab, Iranian, Turkish, Israeli writers who also have moved to the West. So it's harder to talk about the region as though there's some purity about it, because obviously there's movement east and west all the time. But I do think it's important for people who are based in MENA to write from there and to theorize from there, because there used to be this notion, oh, well, you know, theory happens in the West and data gathering happens in the East. And this isn't true. But what is true, I think, is that theorizing happens differently here from there. And the here can be there and vice versa. So that is something I'd like to see a lot more of. And I also do believe so strongly in this digital virtual age that meetings face-to-face in different places is so important. So if we're always going to be meeting in Washington, D.C. or Denver or wherever, San Francisco, there is going to be a sameness to the way in which we talk. But if we go to Cairo or Algiers or Rabat or Tehran, if it's possible, the way we from America will then talk with our colleagues who are based there is going to be different and much more enriching. So my hope would be that we start to do what I had hoped for, I guess, 17 years ago, and that is to start moving out of America as a group of scholars of women in the Middle East and confront as a group what scholars as a group are doing in situ, compelling us to speak differently.
Great. So any final comments or thoughts or things you want to get on the record?
I am absolutely thrilled that you and Soha and Shireen have taken over the journal. This is sort of part of my dream, right? Is not to have any of the founders anywhere near editing the journal.
Great. Thank you so much, Miriam. Ellen McClarney interviewing Miriam Cook on December 17th, 2018.